Do you have more pictures of your goats than yourself on your phone? Does your vacation time get spent attending goat shows? Can you have a conversation without bringing up dairy goats? Neither can we. So join us as we talk to the country's best breeders, judges, appraisers, and industry experts about all things dairy goats. We are John Kane and Danielle Caroli. Welcome to Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. What's up, everyone, and welcome to Ringside. I'm John, and as always, I'm joined by the newbie and enabler herself, Danielle Caroli. What's up?
It's not my fault. They're just awesome, awesome animals, and I feel like you finally have seen the light.
It might be a forced light, but it's sure.
Okay.
Somebody might have shined it in my face, but okay.
Yeah. You're the one posting the selfies with the Nubians, not me. I'm just for the record.
Yeah, it's, you know, a work habit, right? Although I can't help but say sharing is caring, and this is something that we're kind of teaching Alice, 3-year-old. Sharing is caring and needed. But you had some interesting twin does born this week, and you're not sharing.
No. That's right. I am keeping two. I am being greedy and keeping two for myself. Though I have to say, it's been a long time coming. I think I've waited 4 years for these doe kids. So I am hoarding them. They are 62% Nubian. 30 something percent, I'm not doing the math right now, Sonnen, 100% adorable, and I am keeping both of them and just enjoying them so much. And my experimental herd has, you know, increased twofold in the last 30 or 48 hours, 72 hours, whatever it's been. And I'm on cloud 9 right now. So I'm not sharing. I'm keeping them. They're mine.
Sure. Well, when you realize when they start getting bigger and, you know, feed is not getting any cheaper, dibs on one of them. Okay.
Okay. All right. I will. You have a right of first refusal or whatever the proper term is in this situation if I do decide to sell them. And for all the listeners who are kind of just going, what the heck is going on? I know I've talked about it on the podcast a few times, but my experimental kitted with Nubian kids, they are absolutely gorgeous. They are pure white. They actually have pendulous ears. They do not have pure Nubian faces though, so they are not conforming to breed standard. But they are the cutest things ever. So I'm enjoying them, if you couldn't tell.
Well, congratulations again. I'll have to explain to Alice why Aunt Danielle's not sharing. Meanwhile, her favorite goat's going to be ripped out of her arms this week, coming weekend. But that's another story for another day. Danielle, any news on your farm besides those awesome experimentals? Everything else going well?
Everything is going well. I am officially done with my kidding season for 2024. So happy to report that. And I feel, knock on wood, it'll just be smooth sailing going forward.
Well, congratulations. We've got one due this week on Wednesday. She'll be induced for. And then we have a straggler in May, and then we'll be done. So yeah, we're getting there. Not quite as far along as you to say we're finished, but think pink at least times two for this Wednesday. How about that?
All right. I will send, because I have very happily enjoyed the Doe Fairy, but I am all done. I will very kindly send her to you. So maybe that'll make up for the fact. I will share her with you. Maybe that'll make up for the fact that I am not sharing any.
I appreciate that. I really appreciate it, and I thank you so much. Danielle,
There's not much ad good news going on. Kind of quiet. I feel like it's all the prep work for national show coming in T minus insert number of days here. We have been really hitting the gas on this show with bringing some awesome guests in, and today is no different. So, Daniel, how about you introduce our esteemed guest for today?
Okay, it wouldn't be a Danielle introduction if I didn't start with a quick story. Whilst in the throes of kitting out my herd, I was working on heat treating and freezing my excess colostrum. And I was also just kind of listening to podcasts. And one of the podcasts I was listening to was an episode of Boz and Bleats titled Contemplating Colostrum with Dr. Robert Van Saun. After hearing the conversation, I could not help but reach out and see if he was willing to come on to our podcast and talk to us about colostrum, focusing more on the producer side of things to help us all raise healthy kids in this kidding season and beyond. Pennsylvania State University, where he is an extension vet and professor of veterinary sciences, and he is currently focused on small animal nutrition, which we love here. In late 2023, he published his paper, Small Ruminant Neonatal Nutrition, in the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. We are so grateful that he was able to take some time to talk to us today about the importance of colostrum for dairy goats. Another small side note, I actually was talking to my cousin who went to Penn State and was mentioning that we were having him on as a guest, and she just kind of gasped and was so excited to hear it and was telling me that she needed to listen to this. So we are just so excited, and I think this is going to be a great episode. So welcome to the show, Dr. Van Saun.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here. And I enjoy the bantering going on with the Nubians there. I agree with you, Danielle, that I'd keep those two. They sound wonderful.
They definitely should be. And so I started with Nubians, Saanens, well, actually, Snubians were my second love and developed into a Saanen love as well. And this is just the best of both worlds. And so, yeah, they're great. Besides the fact that they're going to be great producers and they're going to show well and all of those fun things, but there's a big place in my heart for them. So I'm very excited to have them here.
We all know that Oberhasli are better, but anyway, to start us off, Dr. Robert Van Saun, can you tell us about yourself and your research?
Sure. Actually, what many people and your cousin there, Danielle, I'm actually more of a dairy cattle person. That's what I did predominantly when I was in veterinary practice. But when I did my, I guess, an important, I guess, what I would call epiphany that I had is when I was in practice, of course, when I left vet school, I said, I'm never going back to school. I've had more than enough school, and I was just going to be the next James Herriot and go out and treat all these large animals and small animals and all of that stuff. And, I got into the practice field, and what I recognized was there was a real disconnect between what they taught us in veterinary school and what my clientele needed. Vet school teaches you all about how to fix broken animals, right? You can treat the sick animals, you can do the surgeries and things like that, but they really didn't focus on preventing the disease. And of course, one of the most important things for prevention is good nutrition. And so that's what motivated me to go back to school, in spite of saying I was never going back to school. And I worked in the area of reproduction, theriogenology, because that, of course, all of our production animals, we need reproduction to make a profit or make a product. And then I did the nutrition side, and I really enjoyed it and enjoyed the research side, answering questions. And so then I went on and did my PhD in nutrition. So I tell my students now that, you know, I've done 16 years of post high school education. And they just look at me and think, you know, they're barely getting their 4 years done. And they're like, God, this guy's nuts. But anyway, that's what prompted me. And one of my mentors during my PhD, basically, even though I was focusing on what we call ruminant nutrition and more on dairy cattle, you know, he said, once you understand the basics of how that rumen works, this wonderful microbial fermentation system, you can adapt it to anything. And that's essentially what I've done with my career. When I left my PhD work at Cornell, I took a faculty position at Oregon State University and got introduced to llamas and alpacas, and was able to identify a critical disease issue due to vitamin D deficiency. And that's changed the whole tenure of how we raise llamas and alpacas now. And then, of course, when I was out in Oregon, I got introduced quite a bit to sheep and goat production. And so that struck a nerve with me and an interest. And then when I moved to Penn State, you know, again, I focused on the dairy side, but received so many calls from small ruminant owners about sheep and goats that I just decided there was such a niche and gaping hole of missing information there with small ruminants that I just needed to do something with that. And so that's where I've headed. And I focused on the first two big research areas that I focused on with sheep and goats is colostrum and pregnancy toxemia. You know, my interest has always been, and my focus has always been on the pregnant animal. I think the pregnant animal is singly the most important animal on the farm because it sets the stage for the entire lactation. And if we mess things up during pregnancy, we've messed it up for the entire lactation. And so, and the same goes, you know, in our topic for tonight on colostrum. You know, if we don't feed that late pregnant female correctly, we can mess up that colostrum, and then that's going to lead us down some real challenges in keeping our young ones alive.
As we mentioned, this episode is focused on colostrum. Before we really dive in, can you explain what colostrum is and why it is so important?
Yeah, there's, I think colostrum is, I mean, from an academic standpoint, we focus on it quite a bit. And I think most owners, when I ask them about colostrum, they focus in on the one aspect of colostrum that, you know, certainly received, let's call 90% of the attention. And that is, colostrum is unique from milk. It's the first liquid secretion of the mammary gland that starts to take place in late pregnancy. And what makes it unique from milk is the fact that the mom will transfer some of her protective antibodies, the unique proteins that can fight off disease, into that colostrum. Now, normally, we break down any proteins that we eat in our diet into the building blocks of those proteins, which are called amino acids. And then we can only absorb amino acids. But there's a brief window in the early life of all newborn mammals, where the gut, the cells that line the intestine, are capable of absorbing these proteins intact. And what that does is it provides early protection against potential pathogenic bacteria or viruses, things like that. As long as mom, of course, has been vaccinated or been exposed to that disease. And so this colostrum then provides this, what we call passive transfer, and gives some immunologic protection. That's the biggest thing. But a lot of what I've been doing is looking at, and also on the dairy side, it turns out that trace minerals, which, you know, these would be things like copper and iron and iodine, selenium, zinc, and so on. Trace minerals are, for the most part, very low in concentration in milk. So I've always been questioning how the mammal species, all varieties of mammals that use this liquid milk or this liquid nutrient from the mammary gland to feed their newborns, how it could be deficient in some of these essential nutrients, because these trace minerals are important for activating the immune response, for playing an important role in metabolism and antioxidants. And it turns out the research that I did back in the 80s and 90s, the fetus is capable of concentrating those minerals from mom's blood. So again, we have to feed the minerals to mom during pregnancy, and then this will be in the fetal liver, but also in colostrum. Colostrum is different from milk in that it will have higher levels of trace minerals. And along that same lines, it turns out that colostrum is also the major source of the important fat-soluble vitamins. These would be vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E for the most part. Those three fat-soluble vitamins don't cross the placenta very well in our ruminant animals because of the thickness of the placenta, the number of layers. And so these animals are born fairly deficient in these fat-soluble vitamins. But if they get a good slug of colostrum, that's where most of their fat-soluble vitamins to get them through the early stages of life comes from. And again, it's dependent on whether or not we're feeding mom those things. So colostrum not only provides passive transfer, it provides essential nutrients that are critical to the survival of the newborn, and we can get into some details on that. Plus, we also know that there are maternal cells and growth factors that are in colostrum and not in milk that help kind of upregulate the metabolism of the newborn animal.
So what happens if an animal doesn't get good quality colostrum, and what can a producer or breeder expect to see when a kid maybe doesn't even get that much needed colostrum?
Yeah. So when we measure the quality, we'll talk about this, that the quality of colostrum is pretty much dependent upon the concentration of immunoglobulin or antibody in the colostrum. There's a unique, a common antibody called IgG, and that's the primary antibody that's in the colostrum. It accounts for like 98% of the antibody that's in colostrum, and that's what's absorbed. And so when they don't absorb that antibody for various reasons, then the problem there is they can survive if the management system, the environment is clean, they do a good job of keeping that animal fed well, good energy balance, good protein balance. Just because they don't get colostrum doesn't mean they're automatically going to die. But if they are challenged in any way, respiratory disease that gets brought into the herd because they took an animal to the show or something and bring them back, or, you know, some other issue, then those animals that have what we call failure of passive transfer, they're not going to be able to fight off that infection very well because they don't have those antibodies ready to fight the infection. They do have an immune system like you and I, but it's what we call naive. It's not been tested yet. And so when it first sees its first pathogen, it's going to take 10 to 14 days to actually gear up and fight that off. And that's just too long. They could die from the disease process, E. coli, salmonella virus, or anything like that before they can mount the immune response. So colostrum is basically insurance, good insurance that we pay to keep those kids healthy and minimize the risk of disease.
Colostrum is definitely just the building block for everything, it seems. But how can we tell if colostrum is like good or high quality, and what are the parameters, and how can we measure them as producers?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, John. As I delved into the literature, as I started to do this, of course, from the dairy cattle side, we've been measuring colostrum and evaluating colostrum for 40 years or more. And we've had a number of different methods that we can use. There's different tests that we can do to indirectly measure the immunoglobulin or antibody production or antibody content of colostrum. And obviously, we can look at some of these other things that I just mentioned, the minerals, the vitamins, and so on, too. Thickness of the colostrum is at least a reasonable indicator of quality. If you have a really thin colostrum, more than likely it may be on the low side, but it's not an absolute. So that's the problem, is just like your forage, you can look at forage and if it looks green or not green, you really can't tell what the protein content is until you actually measure it. Right. And that's where we are with colostrum. And in the literature, one, there's very few studies that have documented colostrum concentration of antibody in goats. And the studies that have been published, they're from around the world. And the numbers are crazy. I mean, there's some studies where the antibody concentration is like 4 or 5 milligrams per ml. And then there's others that are 47 or 50 or something like that. To put that in comparison for cattle, we believe that 50 milligrams per ml is sort of that critical threshold. We consider anything that's 50 and above to be good quality colostrum. And so if we use cattle criteria, many of these studies that were published would suggest either goats aren't like cattle or goats don't make very good colostrum. But it turns out a lot of these studies were done in third world countries where feeding of the pregnant animal is really compromised. And I think that's where a lot of the really poor quality colostrums come from. In the work that we did on a large goat dairy in Northern California, the average concentration, this is average concentration, was 74 milligrams per ml. So even higher than what the good threshold is for dairy cows. And so I think there is a difference. And one of the challenges that we have is we really can't use the dairy cattle criteria or test directly because of the difference in the fat composition. Goats have a unique fat globule in their milk compared to dairy cows. You know, that's why we have the homogenized milk in goats. Mm-hmm. And I think that affects the spectra in using some of the refractometers that are being used to evaluate colostrum on the side. So we did the work. We got a refractometer. You can purchase these, you know, through eBay or through the companies. And what you're looking for is a Brix, B-R-I-X, Brix refractometer. And what it was originally used for is measuring sugars in like wine and pasture and things like that. And there was a paper published in 2010 where they used the Brix refractometer to compare that, the measurement, to directly measured immunoglobulin concentration. And they found a very strong linear association. As the Brix value went up, the concentration of IgG went up in colostrum. And so this paper and what most dairy people would suggest is a Brix of 22 is associated with 50 milligrams per ml or greater of antibody. Well, we did the same thing with goats, and we found that there was a significant linear relationship, but the slope of that relationship was very different in goats than it was in cattle. We also did it in sheep, and we found that the sheep curve or relationship was very similar to cattle and not to goats. And again, I think that reinforces my thinking that it's due to the unique fat that's in goat milk. And what we found is we needed to get up to about 30 Brix to try and achieve that 74 or 75 milligrams per ml concentration in goat colostrum.
That's so interesting, because so often as the dairy goat field is growing, we use the dairy cow as kind of the model, and we just figure our dairy goats are just dairy cows in miniature proportions. And obviously this is very much something that it does not correlate completely directly, and the cows and sheep kind of do, but dairy goats are a whole new field in terms of this.
That's right. That's right. And as I lecture, I always indicate that goats and even sheep are just not small cows. They're a different ruminant. They have a different rate of passage and the way they eat. And we know how goats can sort through their diets and things like that. I mean, there's just such unique aspects there. But yeah, I think the milk fat issue is the key thing with goat colostrum.
Well, you were mentioning the Brix refractometer, and they look fairly inexpensive online. I was looking them up as you were talking here. And is there anything like a producer needs to consider when thinking about purchasing one? And, you know, if they're really, if we can really like gauge where the quality of the colostrum is, like, do you think it's something producers should get?
Yeah. There's an optical Brix and there's a digital Brix. I would go with the digital, and that becomes a little bit more expensive. I mean, generally a good Brix refractometer that I use in my research, although I have multiple functions on it and you can buy them with lesser functions, the ones that I get are usually around $400. Mm-hmm. But I think if you just get a Brix and maybe even, you know, one that measures total protein, you're probably looking at $200 or something like that.
I mean, it kind of changes the ball game if you start to measure what you're using in terms of colostrum. Because I know myself, I have a few does that I more or less could kind of, or I assumed, I guess, because obviously I wasn't testing it, but it was more milky than a very thick colostrum, much faster. And I always try to save colostrum from my does to have a stash in my freezer for the next round. And I wasn't too excited about her colostrum. And it kind of brings up the question, when you have excess colostrum, is this something you should be saving? Or do you earmark some of your colostrum for those really special kids? Or maybe the ones that had a little bit more difficulty if you're testing it and storing it or deciding this is worth using or not using. And so it kind of, I feel like it could be game changing in that management a little bit if you start testing it.
No, and that's where we are in the dairy side. There's a couple important things you really hit on, Danielle, that the most important is I really think that the goat industry has missed the boat, so to speak, with keeping colostrum and banking colostrum. And part of it is, you can't manage things that you don't measure. Right. We, if you don't measure the colostrum quality, then how do you really manage it? You're just guessing. And one of the questions you had for me, and I'm probably getting a little long in the tooth here on some things, but colostrum is made right up to the point until the fetus signals mom that it's time for me to leave. All right, so the parturition process, the kitting process, is initiated by the fetus. The fetus starts to get stressed because of being cramped in space and other factors, and it releases a big surge of glucocorticoids, one of the hormones in our blood, and that signals mom. And then she will release from her uterine walls the prostaglandins that'll get rid of the corpus luteum and then allow the uterus to start to contract and so on. As soon as that glucocorticoid spike hits mom, her mammary gland starts making regular milk. And so, we've documented and others have seen if you collect milk at the second milking, it's already going to be diluted down, and it may not be of good quality. It's really that very first milking, and the earlier you get it, when that doe kids, the better the quality.
So I want to jump ahead because I know that was one of the questions. Sometimes, and I feel that sometimes I'll have does that just look really miserable before they're kidding. Their udder is full. And also, if we are practicing CIE prevention and heat treating that colostrum, sometimes, I mean, it takes about, and you have to have that at temperature for an hour, and it takes time to very carefully bring that up anyway. But if you have a dough that you're, or you don't have a storage stash of colostrum in your freezer, or you have a dough that is full and isn't about, doesn't look like she's going to have kids in the next 12 minutes or whatever it is, or you just know that you need to start heat treating that colostrum beforehand. Is there any damage to milking that colostrum out of a dough before she kids?
Well, a lot is all it's all in the timing. If
Okay.
she's pretty darn close to kidding, then that colostrum will be of reasonable quality, and I would just test it like regular colostrum. But what that is going to do, though, is the next milk that's in her mammary gland is not going to be very good colostrum at all.
Okay.
Can we give something to our does to improve the quality of her colostrum, and like how can we influence it before, and how long before?
Yeah, that's a great question too. So there's a couple different things we can think about. First of all, if we're focusing solely on the antibody that's in colostrum, the first thing you should be thinking about is vaccinating the does. You got to get them to respond, and then that's going to increase their immunoglobulin, and then that should increase the immunoglobulin concentration in the colostrum. So you activate mom's immune response. And the work that's been done in dairy cattle would suggest somewhere in the range of 3 to 6 weeks prior to kitting in terms of getting a good mammary response and antibody in the colostrum. Now, beyond that, there's little data that really tells us much about the colostrum itself, other than energy in the diet of the late pregnant doe, protein content of the diet of the late pregnant doe, are big players. At least some work out of Scotland in sheep has shown higher energy, higher protein values resulted in greater volumes of colostrum being available and higher, slightly higher IgG content. The thing that we don't quite know is what directs the transfer of antibody from mom's blood into the colostrum. I did a study in cattle, and when I fed additional protein sources, and some of these protein sources are what we call bypass protein sources, so it was a quality amino acid blend. I did see in those cows that were fed the higher protein a greater concentration of immunoglobulin in the colostrum compared to cows that were fed a lower protein diet. So there may be some factors there. We just don't have really good numbers and well-defined criteria and guidelines. The other thing we need to think about, of course, is what we talked about a little bit earlier, is making sure that we're feeding minerals and vitamins to the late pregnant animals so that we get good quality minerals and vitamins in that colostrum too, as well as her transferring some of these minerals during gestation.
We were talking about milking out a doe. I just want to circle back on that because I was thinking as you were talking here. I had a doe last year that had quite a bit of colostrum before kitting. In fact, it was like week prior, and she was pretty uncomfortable. One thing that I wish I had done is relieve her because I feel like that played in a part of her attachments breaking down. I know I know the colostrum probably wouldn't have been as good, that far ahead of time, but if I were to have had milked her out, milked that colostrum out, and then fed it to the kids, would it still be better than nothing? Or would I have had to like supplement with some powder, which we're about to get to anyway?
More than likely in that scenario that you describe, the concentration of immunoglobulin is probably not going to be high enough. And you're and again, right now we really don't know what the goal is for what we call passive transfer. Okay, so I mean, what we're talking about here is we have the food resource, the colostrum, that has antibody in it. And then we give that colostrum to the kid. And at least in our early work, we don't see any difference between tube feeding, bottle feeding, or pail feeding for the colostrum in terms of absorption, at least in the brief study in the large dairy that we did this on, and we need to do this more. We're still trying to figure out what is our goal for the antibodies in the blood of the kid? Okay, that's the important part.
Right.
So in dairy cattle, work by one of my colleagues at Penn State back in the 80s, they defined for calves that 10 milligrams per ml of IgG in the blood was considered adequate. Now we can indirectly measure that because it's much harder to measure the IgG concentration. That's what we do in the research, and that's not something that's readily available. But on the farm, you can take a blood sample from the kid and look at it on the refractometer and measure what we call total protein. And so we're establishing guidelines now of total protein. I'd love to see, based on our preliminary work, I think in goat kids, we should be at 6 to 6.5 grams of total protein per milliliter of blood. And that's a little bit higher than what calves are, but there was a recent publication from a consensus study that basically said 10 milligrams per ml was the bottom. I mean, that's just fair. And they think that in this paper, they were suggesting 25 and greater was actually more achievable. What I was able to get to in the kids on this goat farm, we on average had 15 milligrams per ml, and we achieved that by delivering about 36 grams of IgG. So we were able to measure the IgG concentration in the colostrum, and then the farm gave 6 to 8 ounces, and they recorded how much they gave. So then we could calculate the total amount of IgG that the kid consumed. And then we looked at what was in the blood, and we, basically the efficiency of absorption is really only about 16 to 18%. And a lot of that's due to poor quality colostrum, where it sits around a little bit and it's a great bacterial media, and the absorption of IgG is not specific. The gut will absorb bacteria, dirt, things like that, which you really don't want them to absorb into their blood. And that's why it's so important to be really clean, clean the teat ends off, harvest that colostrum. And as Danielle's doing, I think if we're going to try and get rid of CAE, we really need to be working with heat-treated colostrum, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then get that into that kid as quickly as possible, usually within the first 3 to 6 hours.
So I think that leads really well into my next question, or part of my next question. How long would you say a doe is typically producing colostrum for? And also, particularly if we're collecting it, heat treating, feeding it through bottles, how long should we fo be focusing on feeding colostrum to our kids? Or let's say we're in the middle of having, like we're in the middle of kidding season, and so we have a doe that just freshened, we have her kids, we gave her or we gave those kids an initial amount of colostrum. Can we switch them over to milk quickly thereafter? Kind of how does that all work?
That's a great management question. And again, we've been studying this quite a bit on the dairy side, and there's more and more recognition of feeding what we call transition milk to calves and seeing health benefits. So even though they can't absorb the antibody after about 12 to 24 hours, there seems to be a local gut effect by continuing to feed what we call the transition milk, right? So, as I said earlier, She'll only make colostrum up to that moment that the fetus or fetuses signal to her that it's time for them to come out. And then the mammary gland shuts off its ability to transfer antibody, and it just starts making milk. And so that's why it's so important to harvest that really good colostrum right away after kitting. Because if you wait 3, 4, 5 hours, that's going to be diluted colostrum. And by the second milking, it's in that what we call transition milk, so there'll still be a little bit of antibody that was residual in there. But we're also seeing that feeding that transition milk actually has some positive effects on the health and disease resistance of the kids.
What would you say a producer's best practice is in terms of colostrum, and keeping in mind that they want to practice CAE prevention, but also want to feed high quality colostrum to the kids?
Yeah, so first things we would do is as the doe kids, we're going to take a sample of the colostrum from each teat. We can measure it with the Brix refractometer right there. All you need is a drop to put on the Brix refractometer, read the measurement, and then you decide, okay, is this good quality colostrum or not? So as I said, if it's above 30, that's pretty darn good colostrum. And if it's down in the 15s and 18s and things, or under 20, it's pretty weak. So you would want to feed within the first 6 hours, the first big meal. Typically, depending on the size of the kid, we usually talk about 15% of their body weight, or 6 to 8 ounces of colostrum. And then you would want to feed it one more time, within 12 hours or so. And that's really going to set the stage for what they're going to absorb, because much beyond that, the efficiency of absorption really drops like a rock. And again, as soon as they drink anything, like if you give them a milk rather than colostrum or something, that immediately signals the gut cells to start closing down so that they won't absorb. So the longer you wait to get that colostrum in, the lower the absorption efficiency. Now, given if we have a larger farm system, it would be great to heat treat, and there we're starting to get some guidelines. I think we're following the typical heat treatment. You don't want to make colostrum pudding
Oh,
unless you're
right. Been there,
yeah
done that, cried
yeah
some
yeah
tears.
I my understanding is colostrum pudding is a specialty dish of Denmark, so
Oof. No, thank you.
Anyway, and we don't have good data on the doe side, but the work that's been done by my colleague and others on the cattle side has shown we will knock the IgG concentration down slightly with heat treatment, because heat treatment will denature some protein. We see about a 5% drop, but what we found was the efficiency of absorption of heat-treated colostrum is much higher than non-heat-treated colostrum. Now,
Wow.
I would love to prove that in goats. Now, that's what we see in cattle. And my guess is we probably see the same thing in goats, but we need to actually do that work.
That's amazing. And I mean, 5%, unless you're looking at a solar eclipse, isn't that much, but you're potentially creating, besides the fact that you're heat treating and destroying the potential CAE virus. I mean, yonis as well. There's there's a bunch of other things. I mean,
And that's exactly right. One of the downfalls in the goat industry is we got so worked up about CAE appropriately, and we basically wrote off colostrum and got cow colostrum. And unfortunately, what we did is we brought yonis in.
Yeah. Now, if we're having to use powdered colostrum, a lot of it is cow
It's
milk.
all cow. There's no goat powdered colostrum anywhere.
Well, there we go. So is that like, should we probably still be trying to stay away from that, or?
Well, the powdered colostrum is going to be protected. I mean, the
Okay.
big company in Saskatoon that makes most of that stuff, they hyper immunize cows. The cows are under strict feeding practices and disease, health management, and so on and so forth. And then they harvest that colostrum and then they dry it down and sell that. Now, the problem there is, are those cows vaccinated against bugs that the goats are going to see? Right. Again, remember, the whole idea of colostrum is you're giving antibody against the disease pathogens that the goats are going to see. And then the other thing is, I told you earlier from our original study, the amount of the total mass of IgG that we gave to the kids to achieve that 15 milligrams per ml was 36 grams. When you look at these commercial products, they're about 8. And then you
Ooh.
feed two packages, so you get 16. You might even get up to 22 or 24. So it's well below what good colostrum is going to do.
Right.
And there are a few studies in goats, or at least one I can think of, where they fed regular colostrum and colostrum replacer, and they fed it at two different rates, so many, milligrams per kilogram of body weight. And none, only when they fed the regular colostrum at the highest level did they get up to the 15 milligrams per ml that we achieved in our study. The powdered stuff, even at the two rates, barely got up to 10. Didn't even get up to 10.
Wow. That's just amazing. And I just kind of, it's, one of those things that you're trying to do what you think is best for the animal, which especially it, I know colostrum is not fun to heat treat. I mean, thank God for sous vides. I love my canner. It has made heating colostrum so much easier to heat treat it. Versus pasteurization, because pasteurization, you just boil it up, you just bring it up to temp and hold it for 15 seconds and you're good. But it's very stressful to keep that colostrum in the right range and not
Right.
have it go over and create that pudding and all of those things, particularly when you are a seller of animals and CAE, particularly, I mean, in the dairy goat industry is such a trigger. For everyone and everybody wants that CAE free herd. So I,
Yep.
and they may have positive animals, all of that stuff. So what is kind of the best thing, knowing that there is so much importance in making sure they have good quality colostrum? If you have CAE in your herd, is it heat treating it and just being very diligent about it? Can you use cow colostrum from a herd that tests for yonis, like what is the best practice, I guess, is ultimately the
Yeah,
question.
well, to me, the best practice is going to be heat treating doe colostrum. And again, what you can do is, if you use the practices that we've talked about, like measuring the IgG concentration with the Brix refractometer off the bat and harvesting that colostrum, you can heat treat that, and then you can stockpile that. you know, that gives you, that way you can, you would have reserve that you can just pull right out and give to your newborn kids and then take the colostrum that was just generated by the doe that just kitted and then do the heat treatment there. So, you know, ideally we should build up the storage of good quality colostrum, and I would label it. I mean, the work that we've done in dairy cows, we can store colostrum for more than a year and not see any negative effects.
Oh, wow. That's awesome to know. Cause I always try and, I mean, I kind of have a first in, first out for my colostrum. I try and use the last year's stuff first. We work through that. And then I go into, if I need to, my current year stash, I quote unquote, but it's really interesting to know that properly stored, it can last longer for a year, that longer than a year, and not have any effects on the quality if it's frozen like that.
Nope. As long as you do a good job thawing it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to try and thaw it too fast.
Right.
Because you can further heat damage the proteins if you microwave it or something like that.
That makes a lot of sense. So I do want to ask though, let's say you're in a situation where you're in a pinch, maybe you're in a, you have a small herd, you have kids born, the dam dies, you don't have colostrum, and you have to resort to a powdered colostrum or something, or you have only one doe and her, you test her colostrum and it's a poor quality. Are there things you can do to compensate for that lack of quality when you're feeding those kids?
Yeah, so certainly, you know, the industry has shown that they can raise kids effectively on cow colostrum. So I would still look at that. But again, think about the biosecurity practices of getting it from a farm that's Sionis free. And, you know, again, that might even be a little challenging to do. But, you know, you might even get cow colostrum and just heat treat it yourself. And save that. You can use the powdered colostrum knowing the limitations. And what I would do is I would err on the higher side in terms of amounts. You know, I would push the amounts. I wouldn't concentrate it more, but I would feed more than what the label says to try and get up closer to that 30 grams of delivery of immunoglobulin.
Well, as we start to wrap up this conversation, all of what we have talked about is data-driven and learned from research. Where is your research taking you next in terms of small ruminants?
Yeah, so we're continuing to expand our database in both sheep and goat colostrum evaluation and passive transfer. As I said, there's so little data out there. We really need to establish for goats, you know, what the recommendations are. And then the other thing I've been working on is looking at and trying to improve our diagnostics with pregnancy toxemia. That's probably our big disease. In the dairy industry, we have used human glucometers, things that people with diabetes would prick their finger, and then you know, you put a little test strip in the little handheld meter, and you put the blood on the end of the strip, and then it tells you what your glucose concentration is. Well, we have similar to what's been done in dairy cattle and some published studies from overseas. We've documented that we can use a human glucometer to measure both glucose and beta hydroxybutyrate. Beta hydroxybutyrate is the marker in blood that tells us the animal is in what we call ketosis, or that's part of pregnancy toxemia. And we know that pregnancy toxemia you know, it varies quite a bit in terms of prevalence amongst our goat farms, but it's a devastating disease because we can certainly lose the doe as well as the kids very easily. And what we're finding is the interpretation of the beta hydroxybutyrate that we would normally do for dairy cattle is not appropriate for goats.
Interesting.
Yeah. So goats are not as what we'll call ketogenic as what dairy cows are. And so if they go above, millimole, that's probably pretty dangerous for a pregnant goat, as opposed to a cow. And we're also seeing that they maintain their blood glucose right up to a point. And then once that blood glucose drops, everything falls apart. And so we're trying to use this as an on-farm diagnostic. You know, the veterinarian could take a blood sample, or many owners can probably learn to take blood samples, and you don't have to spin the blood down or anything. You use whole blood, and just all you need is a drop. And then what we're doing is we're looking at the metabolic profile of these animals and trying to identify some key blood parameters that can tell us whether or not we're in serious disease status and prognosis is poor or the prognosis is better. In other words, we might be able to give a better idea as to whether we need to go to the emergency C-section or we might be able to treat and move them along. So we're pretty excited about some of the numbers that we're seeing right now, but that's kind of what's on our plate right now.
Oh no, that's awesome. And I'm really excited to hear that. And I've used that blood glucose meter, and I think it's the animal one, which I don't know if it's any different from the human one or if like the strips are slightly different. I don't know that, but it is, and we've kind of talked about it on the podcast as well, something that is a vital tool for all producers, because I know when I have a doe in late stages of pregnancy that is off, I automatically just draw a sample of her blood and put it on the meter, because it either rules out something for my vet and I when we're talking about what's going on and how we're treating it, or it confirms a diagnosis for us and we can start treating it aggressively. And it's just another tool in my toolbox that has either reassured me that, oh, maybe this doe is just uncomfortable and about to kid, and so that's why she's off feed, or, oh no, we are dealing with something and I need to figure out what the best treatment is, whether it's inducing her or it's starting her on like a dextrose or something to kind of push her along as best we can, or add more food and just get her like force feed or whatever the answer is to try and treat that. It definitely is helpful and just a great tool to have as you're working with dairy goats. I mean, I feel like there's some lines that are much more prone to going and having that pregnancy toxemia. And so like working with that and knowing that you can get a handle on what's going on with just a drop of blood is very, very helpful.
Yeah. Now we're pretty excited about that. And just as you said, you know, it gives us on-farm diagnostics that can help us make decisions right away and be quicker to intervene, you know, so that we don't kind of, let's wait and see, right? Let's wait and see, or, you know, let's pull a blood sample. It's got to go to the lab and it won't come back for a few days.
Right, exactly. So to follow kind of up on that, but more so with the colostrum research, and I believe you mentioned something on Boz and Bleats to this effect as well, but you're looking for more data for your further research. And so what are you looking for? And is this something we can kind of crowdsource with the podcast? Can our listeners help you? Because We just deal, we're, I mean, we're dealing with the field. So often we're using dairy cow data. And as you've said in this podcast alone, there are multiple things where we're under the assumption that the standards for dairy cows are what we should be doing. And it turns out dairy goats are a completely different species. And what the standards are for those dairy cows are not for the dairy goats. So are there things, can we crowdsource? Like, are there things we can do to help? Should we be taking samples of the colostrum and sending that information, to, like putting it in an Excel spreadsheet? I mean, is there anything we can kind of do to help?
Well, for us, the more samples we can get from many different farms, that's going to give us a better idea of the goat population in general and what the variation is. And that's going to be important for us to understand. So what we would need is we would need, about 10 mLs of colostrum, and then it can be frozen. And then, we could work out something of shipping that colostrum to us. And then we would measure with the bricks, and we would also measure directly the IgG content. That's got to be done with a special test that can only be run in the lab. And then we can at least start to get a larger database of goat colostrum values to compare to, what's in the published literature. Interesting, we haven't talked about it, and I know this is focused more on dairy goats, but just like we see the difference between dairy breeds of cattle and beef breeds, dairy breeds, because of the genetic selection for milk production, they have poor quality colostrum compared to the beef breeds. And we see the same thing in goats. The meat goats, the boars, and so on, Spanish, they have better quality colostrum than dairy goats.
Well, our dairy goats are delicate little flowers, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I'd say that. They're a metabolic Indianapolis machine. And it's just that when we select them for the higher levels of milk production, we're increasing the level of an alpha lactalbumin protein that stimulates milk secretion. And so we dilute, it causes dilution of the IgG. The total mass of IgG is pretty standard across all the species. It's just a matter of what volume of colostrum they're making.
I really, this is going to be an episode that even after I edit it, I'm going to listen to time and time again, because this has been a lot of information, but a lot of quality and great information. And Dr. Robert Van Saun, if people wanted to find more information about your research or more information about you, where can they do that?
They can search information on the Penn State Extension site. And then that's probably the easiest way to get more information.
Perfect. Well, we definitely appreciate you taking the time on this Sunday to record with us and talk about colostrum. This has, again, just been amazing. And it's I hope we can have you on again someday to talk about other things as well.
Yep.
Yeah, we are so appreciative. This is just all the information we have gleaned today. Again, echoing John's sentiment, just a wonderful conversation. And we thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to do it.
Danielle, if people wanted to find us on the old interwebs, where can they do that?
You can find us at dairygoatpodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook by searching Ringside, an American Dairy Goat Podcast. We are on Instagram and TikTok by searching Ringside Podcast. And you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to leave us a rating, give us a review, subscribe, follow. All of that helps allow us to get into more or to reach more listeners, and we are appreciative of it.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, everybody, this has been Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Danielle.
And there's a reason why colostrum is called liquid gold. Treat it as such. We'll catch you on the next one.
Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast, is not an affiliate of the American Dairy Goat Association. All opinions or information regarding the ADGA does not represent the registry.